Well, today, though, we have Professor Yonder Gillihan, who's Assistant Professor of Theology here at Boston College, where his research focuses on sectarianism in early Judaism, with particular emphasis on the community of the Dead Sea Scrolls and early Christian groups. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Civic Ideology Among the Covenanters of the Dead Sea Scrolls and Other Ancient Voluntary Associations, and has also published articles on the Dead Sea Scrolls and on apocalyptic sects in modern Christianity. Professor Gillihan received his BA and MA in history from Ball State University and his PhD at the University of Chicago, where we were colleagues, overlapped. Before joining the faculty at BC, he taught in 2005, he taught at Yale Divinity School and Dartmouth College. And I know you're working on a new book project that relates to these themes today. I'm sure you'll talk to us about that. And we're delighted to host him today on his talk about the challenges and benefits of civil society in ancient societies and today. So welcome, Yonder, and thank you all for being here.
Thanks, Eric. A pleasure to be here. I want to open up with a talk about the discovery of civil society, a personal history. I began this investigation with a question about the sect of the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is one of the most anti-state sects in antiquity. They hated the Romans, they hated the Jewish authorities, and they resisted them by a sort of partial withdrawal from society. At the same time that the sect of the Dead Sea Scrolls had this extreme anti-state ideology, it also happened in its organizational and regulatory features to resemble other voluntary associations that weren't separatists. Associations of guilds, professional societies, worshippers of Dionysus, mutual aid societies, and so forth. With regard to their initiation rites, the organization of councils, officers, rules for meetings, disciplinary codes, the rules that are defined in the Dead Sea Scrolls resemble rules for these voluntary associations. And the question is, why? Why does this very odd apocalyptic Jewish sect look so much like these societies in Egypt, in Asia Minor, in Rome, in Athens? What explains the similarities? The previous theories, as maybe you anticipate, is that, like all ancient Jews, these Jews were just influenced. They got influenced by the Greco-Roman associations. And so they drew their patterns from what they found in the patterns of the Dionysiac societies, or the profession of guilds. I suspected right away that this was not the right answer. And so I began to investigate other alternatives to why there were so many similarities between the Dead Sea Scrolls sect and these other voluntary associations. As I began to look, I found that I stumbled across another question, and that was, it had to do with the time in which voluntary associations proliferated. They didn't always exist. In democratic Athens, there were very few associations. With the advent of Hellenistic and Roman imperial rule, voluntary associations suddenly begin appearing everywhere. There's this proliferation of associational activity across the Mediterranean world that seems to coincide with the advent of imperial, Hellenistic, and Roman rule. And the question is, why? So that question arose as well. I looked into modern literature on voluntary associations and burrowed pretty deep. The first sources that I came across were from anthropology done in the 60s and 70s on developing societies in Africa. Anthropologists looking at Kenya, also looking at France and South America, noticed that voluntary associations arise in periods of rapid social change. They help citizens make transitions from traditional forms of sociality to new modern forms of sociality. And the voluntary associations tend to take on the patterns of the new society while retaining certain elements of the old. They're sort of practice territory for integrating into the modern form of life. I then came across more literature which leads to the current project. And this literature had to do with civil society. Civil society is the territory within which voluntary associations flourish. I found this in political theorists, political scientists, and political philosophers, from the Neo-Tocquevillians like Robert Putnam to the Marxians in the Frankfurt School. Everybody looks at voluntary associations and civil society as sort of the associations are the core component of civil society. And civil society is essential for social integration and political stability. So I discovered this sort of tool or model for analyzing modern societies and wondered if it might be applicable to ancient societies. The sort of the rudiments of the model that I found useful. Civil society is an arena of social action that lies between and overlaps the private household sphere and the state and political sphere. The central mark of a thriving civil society is the voluntary association. Now, Hegel originates this theory of civil society in his magisterial philosophy of right. In this, in his treatment of civil society, he makes the argument that morality can only be fully realized at the level of the state. Not everyone can participate in politics. And so civil society becomes, for Hegel, an ideal place where people can engage in the type of rational activity that takes place in political spheres without actually participating in political spheres. So Hegel defines civil society and these corporations or voluntary associations within it as places where the morality of the state can be translated into sort of local form. People cooperate together, they rationally pursue self-interest, and they curb potentially abusive, selfish behaviors. They also draw people out of the household into other forms of sociality. This helps to integrate society horizontally. Household members now formerly separated from each other are now cooperating in voluntary associations. The associations therefore integrate a diverse set of subjects. For Hegel, another essential component of civil society is that it overlaps with the state. The associations function as representative bodies before the state. They bring local interests to the attention of the state and can elicit state response to problems that happen at the local level. So civil society provides a way to integrate a diverse population of households. It also provides a way for the for subjects to interact with the state, and thereby cultivates trust in the state and legitimation of the state. Now, conspicuously absent from Hegel's model of civil society is the anti-state or politically subversive association. For Hegel, voluntary associations serve state interests. They disseminate state ideology. They cultivate certain virtuous organizational habits among associations, but he doesn't treat the groups that I was interested in, these anti-state societies. More recently, theories of civil society have expanded to include things like the public sphere, which in which people engage vigorously in debate about economic, political, and legal issues from the bar to the barbershop. These aren't formally organized, but they're vigorous and they're ongoing. New definitions of civil society also include things like social movements, prohibition, women's suffrage, abolitionist movements, and so forth. By and large, theorists agree that participation in the institutions of civil society promotes the idea among subjects that they have a vested interest in what goes on in their society, in their state. They develop habits of trust. Robert Putnam calls this social capital. Habits of trust and cooperation that lead to enhanced participation in broader social activities, as well as in the sort of activities essential for the state, like voting. Associations function in the Tocquevillian sort of school as schoolhouses of democracy. Within the Frankfurt School, there are schoolhouses of patriotism, because we don't necessarily need democracy for them to be present. In any case, the hallmark of a healthy civil society is the proliferation of these voluntary associations. Now, civil society, according to Hegel, and also according to these more recent models, can only appear in the context that's legally protected. In other words, certain states will have civil society and this flourishing of voluntary associations, and others won't, because certain states will grant their subjects particular liberties. These liberties are negative and positive. The negative ones are very familiar to us. Freedom of assembly, freedom of association, freedom of speech. These ones are things without which there can be no civil society. Civil society also requires a minimum of political, social, and economic stability, which is a really interesting insight that's overlooked in ancient studies. Typically, ancient historians look at voluntary associations as symptomatic of decline in the stability of the state. As its institutions break down, associations form to provide new ways of socializing to compensate for this breakdown. The models of civil society that that obtain in the modern world challenge this common assumption. So in theory, civil society solves a number of problems. It solves the problem of a lack of common identity in internally diverse societies, the lack of trust between subjects of diverse backgrounds, and also the problem of the state's legitimation, how to develop trust between subjects and the state. So it ought to be clear that there's a certain moral and political appeal to the idea of civil society. Now, the risk. More recent analyses have stressed the risks of civil society. Not only can civil society and voluntary associations integrate, they can also disintegrate populations. They can for example, people can ally themselves along racial and ethnic and economic lines to the exclusion of people who are not like them. So one risk is that a thriving civil society and the proliferation of associations can actually lead to fracturing of society. Civil society can sometimes turn politics into a spectator sport. This is one of the common complaints. People are more enthusiastic about their bowling league than they are about getting out and campaigning or voting. They will skip a vote in order to attend, a bowling match, to use Robert Putnam's and Weber's and many others' favorite form of voluntary association. One of the gravest risks that civil society and voluntary associations can pose is that anti-state associations will arise. We do find this is a factor. And this is exactly, in fact, the kind of association that I began studying in the first place. So there's a certain risk to granting civil liberties. The risk is something that had been ignored at the beginning of these theoretical investigations into civil society. It's something that's much more at the fore of contemporary investigations and theoretical treatments of civil society and associational atmosphere. For me, there's a strong appeal for civil society theory for the study of ancient associations. It provides a testable thesis for why associations proliferate in some contexts and are absent in others. State law has to grant civil liberties, both negative and positive. Assembly, association, speech, and petition. State law has to guarantee that associational contracts are binding upon members, and if members break those contracts, the state will step in to enforce them. The model also predicts that certain qualities of economic life have to be present in order for associations to thrive, and these are economic stability and a certain level of prosperity. It also explains the state motive for granting the liberties that lead to civil society. The state is motivated by the quest for legitimation. Through the interaction with these associations, the state cultivates and organizes mass voluntary consent to its authority. It trains subjects to identify their own welfare and the pursuit of their own interests with the state's sponsorship by granting them funds or land or resources to pursue their activities. Civil society is appealing to the state because it creates consistent, unified identity across a diverse population of subjects. And of course, when you're running an empire, this is a really important thing. Models of civil society also predict general ideological and organizational features of voluntary associations. They tend to assimilate state ideology. They also tend to adapt state patterns of organization and regulation. And this is a long way after we've already answered my initial question about why these groups existed in such diverse territories so long apart in time, speaking different languages, looked so similar. They're drawing their patterns from the patterns of the imperial state. Models of civil society also predict risks. Associations can disintegrate, destabilize, and even destroy a state. So these are testable hypotheses. We can look and find out whether these things are true for antiquity and perhaps explain the associational activity in antiquity on the basis of these features. Now, the question arises, is civil society an appropriate model for antiquity? It was developed, in fact, to analyze the peculiar nature of modern society. That was Hegel's point in the first place, as the quote on the handout will indicate. Now, my argument is yes, this is actually an appropriate model. Ancient political philosophy, it addresses the very same problems that modern theories of civil society solve. Lack of common identity in subjects with diverse populations, lack of trust between subjects, lack of trust between subjects and state, and legitimation crises in periods of rapid social change. So these problems are things that Plato and Aristotle and others address. They come up with different solutions. Start with Plato. How do you solve these problems? Well, the first thing you do is you find a really nice island. With tons of natural resources and a broad ocean around. Crete will do. You select the 5,040 best Greeks and you relocate them there. You divide the island into 12 territorial tribes, and then further subdivide it into territorial subgroups of these tribes, and then use these villages and deems as locations within which to draw members to participate in the political process, soldiers, and so forth. But you also transform these deems and villages, these small local places, as centers of conviviality, where they engage in things that you would associate with associational activity. Meals. They dine together. They worship together around a common cult. They participate in, or they view music and dance together. So all of these things cultivate a common identity. They also push subjects to invest their identity and their energies in sort of state activities. Because for Plato, these are not private associations. These are actually organs of the state. This is particularly evident in Plato's description of the function of the phratry. In Athens, phratries were formerly voluntary associations. But Plato transforms them from voluntary associations of aristocratic men into compulsory associations that all people have to enroll in order to become citizens of Magnesia. So he erases the voluntary nature and makes everyone members of the phratry. So this syssitia, meal societies, local dining associations, are compulsory now. They're not private recreational clubs, but instead they are clubs to which everybody is required to belong, and to which everybody is required to contribute resources. Everyone is required to attend. They're also supervised by state officials. So in the deans, in the villages, and in the syssitia, we have something like a trispheric model of social activity: the state, the household, and something in between. In these cultic festivals, in these meal societies. But Plato's intermediary sphere is completely controlled by the state. All festival songs and dances are planned in advance and approved. All cults are state cults. All schools are state schools. All meal societies are compulsory state institutions. If you introduce new songs, if you introduce new forms of education, if you even introduce new forms of children's play, execution or expulsion are
So Montessori school. It's not Montessori.
Not at all. I think it's clear that, you know, Plato has no place really for civil society. He recognizes the benefit of the of regular interaction between members of different households and the regular sort of interface between private citizens and the state. But he denies a voluntary nature to this because he fears political division. Plato's Magnesia has no civil society, and the voluntary associations that appear to stand at the center are actually state-run. Voluntary associations present the worst type of threat to state stability. In my analysis of Plato, I suspected, you know, he must be reacting to something. These laws don't just come out of nowhere. It's interesting, one of Plato's laws is that people of citizens of Magnesia can make contracts to form associations, but the state will never step in to enforce those contracts if people decide to break them. So Plato recognized the risk of civil society, and he denied the civil liberties necessary for its formation. He crafted a careful sort of semblance of it, but kept it carefully and tightly controlled under the aegis of the state. Aristotle's opinion was vastly different. Aristotle begins not with a desire to create a completely homogeneous population, but he begins by talking about a polis as something that constitutes not only a number of people, but people of different kinds. Diversity is not a threat for Plato or for Aristotle. Rather, it's good. A polis needs many resources. The more types of resources, the better. Among the diverse population, which can remain diverse, a certain type of unity can be cultivated through education. And so Aristotle pushes very strongly for the centrality of education in unifying a diverse population. Aristotle also agrees with Hegel, and here's where I think that the models of civil society can talk with ancient models from ancient political philosophy. For Aristotle, the highest morality, the highest friendship, trust, and justice is in the state, the polis. The lesser goods are only available in minor associations within the state. And this is evident in the first two quotations from Plato's Nicomachean Ethics that I provide. Like Hegel, Aristotle clearly values liberties as essential to political stability. We can infer this from his contrast in the ways in which good kings and bad kings maintain constitutional stability. The bad tyrants will prohibit messes, private meal societies, will prohibit private clubs, will prohibit education, will keep an eye on anything that engenders high-mindedness and trust among subjects. Everything possible that he can do to ensure that people are as ignorant of one another, he will do, because mutual knowledge between subjects gives rise to mutual trust, which can lead to collective activity, which can lead to an overthrow of a tyrant. So residents, subjects of state, have to be always in public view and pass their time at the palace gates. I think he's talking about Plato's Magnesia. What exactly should the kingly tyrant do? The good one. Plato, or Aristotle, says exactly the opposite of the bad tyrant, but he doesn't elaborate. I think, however, we can infer that he would agree. The good king should cultivate bonds of trust between subjects, provide for high and noble intellectual pursuits, cultivate associations that build mutual knowledge and trust among subjects, like dining clubs, like recreational associations, encourage subjects to form schools on their own, and also encourage all sorts of non-public activities and gatherings. Now, it's interesting that, like Hegel, Aristotle says nothing positive about associations with political agendas. Nothing. Unlike Hegel, Aristotle explicitly addresses stasis, or political factions, and condemns them at length. He describes the conditions under which they form, their aims, and especially how to prevent them. For Aristotle, there's no legitimate place for politically active voluntary associations in a stable state. And yet, Aristotle admits that there are certain constitutional states in which there are many politically active voluntary associations, and it confounds him. It's the constitution that contains these happens to be located on the oligarchic island state of Crete, which Plato will depopulate and repopulate with his 5,040 best Athenians. Now, in the interest of time, I'm going to end with a sketch of ancient political theory and not get into what actually happened in Hellenistic and Roman law. I'll make a few broad comments that show where the work ends up. In brief, Aristotle's more optimistic and pragmatic approach won the day. Voluntary associations, and I would argue a form of civil society, flourish under Hellenistic and Roman imperial rule. Why? I think that in a time of rapid regime change, the empires felt a profound need for legitimation. They strategically extended civil liberties to their subjects and actively engaged them in associational life. They gave them money, property, goods for banquets, and some exemptions from taxes. Promoting associational life also had the effect of separating and organizing local subjects into discrete groups that could be easily engaged and managed. In a way, the extension of civil liberties in the imperial age actually had the effect of democratizing access to the state and to the economy. Formerly disenfranchised subjects now had the opportunity to engage positively and effectively with authorities. They also had a formal status in the law. I think for the Roman Empire, it's arguable that we can attribute long periods of political and social stability to the cultivation of civil society through the extension of these types of liberties. But as in modernity, the cost of liberties can be significant. The laws and the historical narratives show how constantly state authorities strove to balance the benefits of civil society with its risks. In most cases, they were successful. The Roman Empire lasted a long time. Sometimes state action was paranoid and brutally suppressive. Other times, in some local contexts, interest groups provoked social fragmentation and political disaster. You see this happening in Judea with the proliferation of political groups and the eventual destruction of Jerusalem in the Jewish War against Rome. Here's a key curiosity that I still am interested in trying to figure out. From the early Hellenistic era until late antiquity, we find associations like the sect of the Dead Sea Scrolls that have political ideologies and identities that differ from that of the state. They last a long time, and they're not ever put out. They're never quashed. Besides the Dead Sea Scrolls sect, we find this kind of alternative civic identity and explicit dissent among Epicureans, Cynics, Stoics to a certain extent, and also early Christian sects. These obviously didn't disappear. Now, what I'd like, I'll stop. I think the time has come. But there's a second risk. So I've identified one particular risk, and that's the rise of these anti-state associations within civil society, along with other risks. A second risk associated with civil society is its possible inappropriateness for the study of antiquity. As I noted, the model of civil society that Hegel develops is intended to explain phenomena within modern life. He denies, in fact, that internal diversity existed within the ancient city-states. And says, you know, this sphere of social activity only is peculiar to modernity. And so using models of civil society for the analysis of antiquity presents its own sort of risk. Developing the model in a way that makes it appropriate, or jettisoning the model if in fact it isn't appropriate, I think is something to consider. Thank you.
Terrific. Thanks so much.
Okay.